Greetings, everyone, and welcome to episode 14 of the Yogic Studies podcast. In today's episode, we speak with Dr. Amanda Lucia from UC Riverside about her new book entitled White Utopias, The Religious Exoticism of Transformational Festivals, just recently published in October 2020 by the University of California Press. In this episode, we discuss the nature of religious exoticism, white possessivism, and cultural appropriation in North American yoga and bhakti communities, which, as Amanda's work bears out, have become predominantly white spaces dominated by white teachers and practitioners. This book takes seriously the critique of whiteness in yoga, while at the same time taking seriously the earnestness and devotion of white yogis and bhaktas. This is by no means an easy project or even comfortable conversation at times, but it's an important and timely one. I wish we would have had a little bit more time. At the end, you'll hear the podcast gets cut a little bit short, but I hope that this can generate further discourse and conversations, both at Yogic Studies and outside in your local communities. As this podcast continues to develop in the coming year, I'm planning to bring on more scholars, in particular of South Asian descent and people of color, to expand the diversity of voices and perspectives engaged in this type of critical yoga research. All right, with that in mind, allow me to introduce our speaker today. Amanda Lucia is Associate Professor of Religious Studies at the University of California at Riverside. Her research engages the global exportation, appropriation, and circulation of Hinduism. She is the author of White Utopias, The Religious Exoticism of Transformational Festivals, published in October 2020 by UC Press, which investigates the intersections of whiteness and religious exoticism among the spiritual but not religious at transformational festivals such as Bhakti Fest, Wanderlust, Lightning in a Bottle, and Burning Man, with a particular focus on yoga practice. Her previous publications include Reflections of Amma, Devotees in a Global Embrace, 2014, and numerous articles. She is currently crafting a body of research on sexual abuse in guru-led religious communities. Okay, without further ado, please join me in welcoming Dr. Amanda Lucia. Amanda, welcome to the Yogic Studies podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Congratulations on the new book, White Utopias, The Religious Exoticism of Transformational Festivals. I was delighted to receive a copy. Thank you so much for that. Academics love getting free books, so I've really enjoyed, you know, over the last week going through this book, and I'm very, very excited to have you on to discuss today. How's it been going with the launch of the book? What does an academic book launch look like right now during a global pandemic?
Yeah, it is honestly ironic in some sense to launch a book that's all about connectivity and massive crowds and people getting close and getting physical and breathing on each other and sweating on each other in these kind of extraordinary spaces, not even including all of the travel that people do to go to these festivals all over the world. You know, honestly, I think it's in some sense good for us to remember what is possible and to maybe look forward to hopefully a place where things can become closer. Practically, it's involved a lot of Zoom rooms, which is kind of, in a way, can be beneficial because people can come from all over the world. So in some ways, all of that travel and movement has been erased. And so I've had quite large and interesting crowds coming to Zoom rooms to hear about it. So that's kind of surprising and in a way kind of a plus.
Yeah, I think I saw you were doing something for Yoga Alliance, maybe a conversation or workshop there. And I know you're doing something.
They asked me to come and speak, which was a generous invitation. I don't really have any ties to Yoga Alliance, but it was nice of them to invite me. And then, yeah, SOAS in a few weeks, and LMU here, Loyola Marymount University in LA, has a yoga studies master's, which I will plug for them right now. But they invited me to come speak and, you know, here and there, different universities, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah, that is sort of the circuit, if you will, in yoga studies. Well, yeah, again, just, you know, congrats on finishing the book and getting it out, especially during, you know, these difficult times. It's clearly a book that you've been working on for quite a while now. So tell us a little bit just about the book project and how it came about, and what, you know, like, where did the idea come from, you know, for writing such a book?
Right. So, well, I guess a little bit about me might be helpful, because I think sometimes people look at my research and they think, you know, how does she get from A to B? Mm. So I started off working on contemporary guru movements, particularly Amma, Mata Amrita Nandamai, and I wrote a book called Reflections of Amma. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I noticed, it was only just one chapter of that book, but was that there was a division between what I saw to be kind of Anglo or white satsangs, meaning congregational gatherings, and satsangs that attracted South Asians. And this wasn't a stark divide necessarily. It wasn't 100%, but it was noticeable and evident, and even articulated in, institutionally, in terms of like, Indian canteen and a Western canteen, or Indian dining hall, Western dining hall, Indian dormitories, Western dormitories, things like that. Mm-hmm. So I noted it and paid attention to it, but it wasn't the focus of that book. Then when I came to California, Southern California, in 2011, after I took a job at UC Riverside, I wanted to get involved with the South Asian Hindu community to learn more about kind of where I had landed in the academic job market. And so I happened to pick up a flyer for a thing called Bhakti Fest at my daughter's preschool, of all places. It wasn't even any kind of strict academic pursuit. And so I thought, hey, Bhakti means devotion. This must be Hindu South Asians in Southern California having some kind of a gathering. So I decided to go. And when I went, and I narrate this in the book, but when I went, I was really surprised to note that almost 95% of the participants there were white. So it was a very different event than what I thought it was. I probably should have done a bit of homework or research before I went, but I was just kind of going to see. And hadn't. And so at that point, though, I realized, after talking to people throughout the course of the 4 or 5 days of the festival, just how intent some of these practitioners were. And I met people who were ex Osho or Bhagwan Rajneesh devotees, mm-hmm. current Hare Krishnas, or the International Society for Krishna Consciousness devotees. I kind of got looped into the kirtan or devotional music circuit here in Los Angeles and LA. And then, of course, yoga dominates the festival with about 70 yoga classes offered. And in fact, so much demand for yoga there that they have to limit people to 3 a day. Mm-hmm. And then the yoga practitioners, you know, of course, there were some who were just there to kind of enjoy, but I would say a strong majority were there to learn and to learn and deepen their practice. And what I found in particular was that it was very spiritualized yoga. People were not just kind of exercising in the desert. In fact, they were looking for religious or spiritual roots. So that piqued my interest, and I began to follow these practitioners to other festivals that they were going to, which then took me to Shakti Fest, which is the partner festival for Bhakti Fest, also in the same place. And then Wanderlust yoga festivals, then Lightning in a Bottle, and then finally Burning Man, which is not explicitly focused on yoga, but in fact has the, of course, the most yoga of any of these festivals because of its size. And also a real commitment or interest in spiritual or consciousness expansion, transformation. In fact, that's transformational festival is where that word comes from.
So it started with bhakti and kind of following the thread of bhakti, looking for bhakti in your local area and community, and that led you to transformational festivals.
Yeah, I mean, that was my kind of snowball methodology of following the people. So what I was very surprised about was the ways in which these circles overlapped. So I would see people that I knew from then other festivals, and yoga teachers from one festival would go to another festival. Same with kirtan artists. And in fact, as the years go on, I see more and more overlap. I'm reflecting on, there's so-and-so at this festival. So I think I'm even more than at the beginning. Now I see this as kind of a global circuit of practitioners and interested bhaktas or devotees.
Right. In one of the appendixes, you tell the story of Luke.
Yeah.
You started to just see everywhere in all of these different, what were on the outside seemingly very different festival spaces, but there would be Luke everywhere.
He is everywhere. I mean, I love that character and I love that person in so many ways. In fact, somebody random just showed me some video from a consciousness expo, and he was there too. So he is particularly nomadic and particularly mobile. But I really do feel that there are many characters, people like that, who become characters in the book, who are moving in global circuits looking for spiritual information, looking for awakening, looking for experience. And those circuits go from the coast of California, but then also into Canada, to Bali, to New Zealand, even Thailand, India, a kind of global circuit of yoga and spiritual travelers.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very familiar personally with some of those spaces. I've attended Bhakti Fest, Shakti Fest. I've spent time at Amma's ashram in San Ramon, California. So it was really interesting for me reading the book and some of your field work and descriptions of these spaces and people and places, because I could really feel it. I could be there. I could imagine these exact conversations that you were having. You know, the exact people, even if not by name, right? But the people that you're interacting with, that you're describing, that you're immersing with.
Well, that's good. I love that. I mean, in fact, that's what the book aims to do. In fact, to let people see a world where it should be recognizable to people who are at all familiar, right? So that's good.
Yeah. So it started a little bit with bhakti, but then you were following the people, and this led to kind of the larger transformational festival circuit. So, I mean, what are transformational festivals for those who are listening who might not be familiar with these sort of festivals and spaces? You know, how do you describe transformational festival in your work?
I use the term as a very loose umbrella term. And there are many different iterations of what a transformational festival is, oftentimes influenced by the visions of the founders or producers or the idea generators, whoever was kind of at the root of it. There's a wide spectrum, and that's one of the things that I try to make very clear at the beginning of the book, that I'm not trying to conflate or flatten difference at all. In fact, I think one of the interesting things is that there is some continuity despite the very distinctive transformational festival worlds that these cases that I've pulled together are creating. So my definition, as I kind of use it in the book, is just a sense of a festival that is bringing people together with a goal toward spiritual transformation. And they all use that particular word, even though, importantly to note here at the beginning, Burning Man Project has dissociated from the category of festival. Mm-hmm. They would prefer to be understood as either a project or just Black Rock City, a place where I think what they're reacting against is this notion that as a festival, one has a experience that one purchases as a result of a ticket purchase, which then is one is granted an experience. And they want to emphasize the fact that Burning Man doesn't guarantee you any kind of experience. In fact, with the purchase of a ticket, you're just kind of buying the cost of porta potties. And what you create in Burning Man is Black Rock City is up to you. So kind of pushing back against the exchange value of a ticket.
Mm-hmm. And Burning Man, among your case studies of these festivals, or those that resist to be labeled as festivals,
yeah, exactly.
It is very unique in its own way, would you say?
Yeah, it is. But I think that one of the reasons I included it was, in some sense, because it's the grandfather of many of this, maybe even of the majority of this culture, broadly conceived, in that it does a lot of the, it created a lot of the roads that later transformational festivals walk upon. How about that? Mm-hmm. So even if they kind of branch out and do things differently, Burning Man is kind of an ancestor, let's say.
Mm-hmm. And then what were the other ones? Let's talk about them a little bit.
Sure.
The other festivals that you focused on, and then just tell us a little bit about the nature of your field work at these sites, because I think you spent something like 7 or 8 years kind of conducting field work at these festivals.
Yes, I did. So Burning Man, as I just gave you a little bit, Lightning in a Bottle was birthed from, I believe, burners meaning people who are committed or go to Burning Man, but burners who wanted to create a more Burning Man-like, but accessible experience. So the Do Lab is the production company behind Lightning in a Bottle. And they also have a stage at Coachella. So one can kind of see Lightning in a Bottle as kind of a middle point between Coachella and Burning Man. So not just a kind of music festival for the masses, but then not also this kind of far away survivalistic, difficult to do large scale event in a remote desert of Nevada. Lightning in a Bottle is explicitly focused on knowledge sharing as well. I think that's a distinctive part about that festival, and that they have all kinds of different resources for people to learn about permaculture or indigenous medicines or, of course, yoga plays a large part, but there's kirtan, there's all kinds of ways to expand your horizons as a participant, in addition to kind of being a large scale music festival. Then Wanderlust festivals are also, I would say, fairly educationally oriented, though they are focused on yoga. And I would say they're the most touristic in some sense of all of the festivals that I looked at, in that they are part luxury vacation. I would say that's fair. And that's part of their allure. But then they're also focused on really some of the most vigorous yoga training that I saw or experienced bodily in any of these festival spaces. Very serious yoga aficionados, a lot of teachers, a lot of yoga teachers who go to them. And then also this kind of really close engagement with nature as a source of inspiration in Wanderlust festivals, a very athletic group.
Does that one take place in Lake Tahoe in Northern California?
There is, yeah. There's one in Squaw Valley. That's probably the closest to us. But then lately, they've really expanded. I mean, during the course of my field work, I went to Wanderlust in New Zealand and Sunshine Coast, Australia, mm-hmm. and Mont-Tremblant, Quebec, Stratton, Vermont, Whistler, BC. But lately, I've been noting, kind of after the book was done, that they've really been expanding to have these festivals in places like Seoul, South Korea, making them more global. So that's kind of interesting.
And I remember just hearing, you know, at a time, those were a little bit more exclusive in the financial commitment, let's say, to go to one of those. Is that right? And that there's sort of different tiers and packages, and I don't know. I remember hearing about some sort of elite events you had to pay for that were, you'd like kind of take the ski lift up to the top for this private yoga class up at the top of the mountain, this sort of thing.
Okay, so this is how the yoga world works, right? There's like rumors that flow through everywhere. Yeah. I'll tell you what I know, in that Wanderlusts are moderately expensive, but not that much more than any of these other festivals. I wouldn't say, I don't remember the ticket prices, something like $300-$400, which is, you know, even if you add up the number of yoga classes you'll be taking, not all that much. In comparison, you know, Bucky Shucky Fest are similarly priced, as is Lightning in a Bottle, maybe is a little bit cheaper. Burning Man is a little bit more expensive.
This is for like a weekend event?
Usually they're, I think, something like Thursday through Tuesday. So it's about 5 days. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The cost extraordinarily increases when you talk about travel, right? I mean, getting from LA to Bali or LA to Thailand is going to add loads to the package of what it costs to do that event, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're just driving to Squaw Valley, it may very well be worth it for kind of, you know, round the clock yoga and kirtan and educational talks and then concerts every night. I think if you kind of do the math, that's one of the reasons why I think transformational festivals have become so popular. I use the example in the book of like the Lollapalooza model of mm-hmm. seeing all your favorite bands in one place in the course of 4 days. If you added up all those mm-hmm. different ticket prices, it would break the bank. Mm-hmm. As far as elite yoga classes at the top of the ski lift, I've not seen that, no. In fact, what they had at Squaw Valley when I went was free camping at the top of the ski lift, which I did. So I ended up taking the ski lift, which I found terrifying because I'm not a skier. But then you could camp at the top, and the views were astounding of Tahoe. And they did have some yoga classes up there. I think they also had a party one night and maybe a roller disco, I think, if I recall.
Okay. All right, good. Well, we can put that rumor to rest.
I guess on that note, Burning Man does have a very elite tier where you can pay, I think it's $1,500 for your ticket if you want to, instead of the normal $480 or whatever it is, $475. And I think that's targeting people like Beyonce or Elon Musk, who just kind of like want to give back to the community through their ticket purchase. Mm.
And Burning Man, I mean, I want to get to Shakti Fest too, but just on the note about money at Burning Man, they have a very unique model. Is that right? Is it still true that once you buy the ticket, once you're there, that there's no monetary, there's no money that's exchanged to buy food in this, that it's more of a barter and trade system on the inside?
Yeah, nothing is for sale at Burning Man except for coffee, which is only located in one space, which is at Center Camp. You can go get coffee if you want to spend
money. $30 a cup?
No. Normal prices, like a couple dollars.
One thing, yeah, okay.
And then ice. ice at Center Camp and ice at, there's a couple other ice outposts, two others, I believe, in the city. Mm. So that's all you can buy. And even, most people, I would say, really, at least it traditionally was, it's changing now, but a really great opportunity to put away your phone and your money for 2-3 weeks.
Right. Yeah, I could see how that could be transformative.
Even just that little interesting experiment.
Yeah. And we'll get into some of that more because, I want to talk about how you, later in the book, you bring up how the act of going to these, you look at it through the lens of asceticism and a certain type of denial and renunciation. And I think that kind of fits into that a little bit. So maybe we can come back to that later.
For sure.
But let's talk a little bit more about on the yoga and the bhakti side of these festivals. Where were you attending?
Sure. So the last one that we had started with, and I'd circle back, was Bhakti Shakti Fest, which are important in that they are explicitly devoted to bhakti, which mm-hmm. is a word meaning devotion in many South Asian religious cultures, but particularly in their vision, they're talking about Hindu culture. And I think that is really the heart of that festival, of both of those festivals, is this focus on bhakti. And in fact, the tagline for the festivals are be in the bhav, B-H-A-V, which is this mood or emotion of bhakti. Trying to cultivate, in fact, at the beginning of the festivals, they were running kirtan, meaning devotional music on the stages 24 hours a day to try to kind of cultivate this energy, this mood throughout the course of the festival that would connect people with a sense of devotion. So there's a lot of Krishna bhaktas who attend, and the yoga there as well is oftentimes very oriented toward devotion, toward spirituality, even toward Hindu ideas and Hindu worldviews. So I found that to be one of the other fascinating parts about this work, was that these were not the studio yoga classes, where in fact we know that many teachers are restricted in what they can say, or they are told by the studio owners to be more secular or to not philosophize. Sometimes, or not use Sanskrit, even in some cases, where in these classes, teachers were in fact free to talk about whatever they liked. And in some sense, they were oftentimes, at the beginning, I had kind of identified these as kind of yoga sermons that were happening during classes, where sometimes teachers would either speak through a yoga class, thinking about spiritual and religious ideas, or they would in fact have a section of the yoga class, maybe even like 45 minutes, that was just a lecture before mm-hmm. they would get into any kind of movement practice.
Right. A Dharma talk of sorts.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right. I think that's very astute. I think, I think some of those teachers, probably if you went back to their studios, they might be the more religious or spiritually oriented asana teachers as well. Mm-hmm. But I think, as you note in some of the interviews with them, they themselves say they feel much more free to express their devotion outside of that studio context. So that is pretty interesting. And of course, not surprising if it's Bhakti Fest, it's people who are coming more explicitly for the devotional aspect.
Right. One note on that. I would want to note that the yoga teachers in this book, many of them are very famous, and they have their own enterprises. So although it is important to note that there's a distinction between the studio class and the festival class, some of these yoga teachers can kind of say whatever they want, right? they've got their own platform, and they've got their own websites and their own kind of even companies or organizations that they are the head of, and they're not confined by kind of a studio owner telling them what to do and what not to do.
So on the subject of the yoga teachers in this book, when I get a new book, one of the first things I like to do is pick it up, flip through it, look at the table of contents, look at a bibliography, an appendix, kind of how we're academically trained to kind of pick up a you know, a monograph, right? And so I was immediately drawn to your appendixes in the back. And the first one is Instagram data for public figures cited. And you have a list of yoga teachers and the number of their followers on Instagram. And I'm looking at this list and I'm thinking, why don't I recognize any of these names of these yoga teachers, right? I've been doing this for a while and I feel like I have a pretty good sense and pulse of kind of the yoga world and industry and who the big names of the teachers are. And I'm looking at this and I'm just so puzzled. I'm just like, either I don't know as much as I thought, or maybe she just interviewed kind of a bunch of lesser known people. I'm looking at the number of their followers. I'm like a little bit puzzled. I didn't notice that in parentheses you had written pseudonym. And then of course I read on in your notes in the methodology of the book, and for good reason, right? You made the decision to change the names of a lot of the teachers and the informants in the book. So tell me just a little bit about that and, you know, the decision to do that. A little bit about then how, I guess, your work as a scholar of religion, as an ethnographer, doing this field work, how this was received by these kirtan leaders, by these yoga teachers. And yeah, I guess why you decided to put the pseudonyms rather than using their names in the book.
Sure. That's kind of funny, honestly. I like your story. You're like, oh gosh, do I not know the things that I think I know?
Well, let me also say, I then, though, as I was reading it, there's a particular section in the book where you talk about the teachers using their pseudonyms, but you give a little bit of a biographical description of who they are without using their name. And so for someone who does know, or with a little Google search, I was definitely able to crack the code of some of your pseudonyms.
Oh no, that's terrible.
So I definitely know who a good handful of these teachers are now.
That's a danger. I mean, with pseudonyms in ethnographic work, the goal is to create an anonymous account for those who are outside of the immediate. So someone who's not familiar, you know, as deeply as you are with the kind of yogic world should not be able to kind of do the work that you just did. With someone who is kind of in this field, as you said, kind of like overlapping in a lot of these festival circuits, right, that it's going to be almost impossible to hide entirely. So keep it to yourself if you can. That would be great.
Of course. And
of course, you could always be wrong. That could be terrible.
That's true. Why did you feel the need, or what was behind the decision to include the Instagram follower numbers? I was honestly just curious what.
So I think one of the reasons to include that is because I wanted to make clear that many of the yoga teachers in this book are influencers. And they're influencers in the yoga circuit, that people are listening to them, that it's not just kind of, also I worked very hard to interview a lot of kind of the most famous yoga teachers in the kind of US context in particular. And I felt like once I gave them pseudonyms, I was almost kind of like, disheartened, because I thought, well, geez, I could have just gone to my local yoga studio right here down the block and interviewed the teachers, and the reader wouldn't know any different. You know, they wouldn't know that, like, I flew to Australia to go interview somebody. Mm-hmm. So I thought that that was important. Now, with that said, it's kind of interesting that I thought that these numbers were quite large. Like, I give Lena Bryant with 155,000 Instagram followers. Mm-hmm. But you know, right now, my daughter during quarantine, she's 12, she's become TikTok famous and she has 60,000 followers on TikTok.
Wow.
So, yeah. But I think it's,
did she drink some cranberry juice on a skateboard or something?
Exactly. No, she's got her little art channel, but I think it's kind of all perspectival, you know, in whether these numbers seem big to you or small to you. They range from you know, maybe 160,000 to down to 14.
And I would also say some of these teachers are probably bigger influence in shaping the yoga world than these numbers maybe even lead on, for some of them in particular. But it does say something about their influence in the ways in which they're able to share ideas and practices and values about yoga or kirtan and have that impact, you know, their followers. So it is interesting to think about that.
I think I also wanted to be transparent and let readers understand the difference in the different festivals. So for example, the number of followers on Instagram, you can see Bhakti and Shakti Fest have only approximately 26,500 followers, whereas Burning Man has 992,000. So to recognize just the difference between these worlds.
Yeah.
And as a second part to your question, you know, honestly, I started off in this work with the conventional ethnographic understanding that people should be given pseudonyms to protect their identities, but not public figures. That's the conventional rule in anthropology, or, you know, I mean, there's so much discourse in anthropology and ethnography about the right way to do field methods. But I think that's tends to be a common understanding that if someone is famous then, or a public figure, then it would be kind of silly to give them a pseudonym, right? Mm. So that's the way, like if you were writing, for example, about Barack Obama, you know, as the president of the United States, and you gave him a pseudonym, that's a silly thing to do, right?
Yeah, right. But what if he's the Barack Obama of the yoga world?
Yeah, exactly.
The lines are a little bit more ambiguous.
Well, then I ended up talking deeply with our research board about what the meaning of fame was. I mean, to me, they were very famous in the yoga world. But our IRB board at Riverside, at UC Riverside, kind of said, well, do they have the blue check? Are they verified? And that was an interesting thing. If you can find that, if you go to Instagram, people like Oprah, right, would be verified in that sense.
Yeah.
And then there's the kind of secondary layer that made all of this extraordinarily complex and relevant, which is that many of these people didn't want to be talking or identified in a book about whiteness. Mm-hmm. So I think that there was a considerable concern that including their names, even though I feel like most of the quotes from the people in question are pretty benign. You know, I don't have anybody saying anything extraordinarily outrageous, but still, even being connected with that topic could be a danger to their brands and therefore their livelihood. So I think as a bit of an abundance of caution and in deference to their sometimes very serious critique, you know, concerns about being involved in such a book, I decided to give pseudonyms to all of the people in the book, regardless of fame, regardless of status.
Because you note that you did send chapters or sections of the book to your informants, and you did actively you were transparent with them about what you were writing, and you in some cases even asked, you know, for feedback. Is that right?
Yeah, I absolutely believe in that. I feel like ethnographers should be in dialogue with their informants. And so after I completed a draft of the book, I sent the sections and the title, table of contents, the sections in which they were quoted to everyone I could find and solicited feedback from them. I would say like 95% of people wrote back and said that they were either happy with it, surprised about it, but content. And some people offered kind of minor critiques, minor tweaking. Hey, can you take this out? Hey, can you make this even more anonymous? That kind of critique or commentary. Mm-hmm. Some people were stoked, like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be in a book. That's amazing. Other people were like, I don't know about the topic matter, but I think this is good work that the community needs to consider. So other people said, you know, that was a difficult festival for me and I'd rather not be identified by name. Can you please use a pseudonym? And so once I then said, hey, I'm using pseudonyms for everybody, people became more comfortable, I would say, in general. Mm-hmm. And then I had three really vicious and straight angry reactions from white yoga teachers who had their legal teams and their branding representatives and marketing producers contact me. And I had to negotiate each of those three circumstances. One was relatively diffused with a kind of a long and rough phone call. Mm. One was kind of a back and forth for about 6 to 8 months about how to kind of more carefully craft the person's appearance in the book. And one I was unable to resolve and I ended up withdrawing that person and their interview content from the book entirely. Direction.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, let's dive a little bit into the heart of the matter then, which might explain a little bit why some of these teachers might have been hesitant to have their names or brands associated with a book that is called White Utopias. So as we've kind of been talking about it, again, you're looking at bhakti, you're looking at yoga within these transformational festivals, within, you know, these circuits and events. But why is it White Utopias? Where does this aspect of the project emerge? And what are White Utopias?
Right. I think that, I mentioned it kind of at the beginning, was just the shock of finding a festival fully dedicated to South Asian culture and religion that was almost entirely white when I first went to Bhakti Fest in 2011. But at that point, my intention was not really to study whiteness. I was kind of just more curious and learning about these fields and what people were interested in, what they were looking for in attending and participating in these fields. And then as I continued to go to festivals and saw more of a pattern emerging wherein the festivals were, especially the ones focused on yoga and spirituality or spiritual exploration through cultural context, were about 90 to 95% white, with wanderlust probably being the ones focused on yoga being even whiter than maybe a Bhakti and Shakti Fest by, you know, just a few percentage points, I would say.
Yeah, that's kind of a shocking paragraph in the book, actually. You know, you're listing the demographics, these different festivals, and most of them are predominantly white, but ones like Burning Man or Lightning in a Bottle are a little bit closer to like U.S. census demographics of ratios, right?
Well, kind of. So Burning Man, for example, is, I believe, as per the last census, about 77% white. Lightning in a Bottle is probably about the same, though they don't publish demographic data. But what makes this, I guess, more stark than the U.S. general demographics is that if you look at California, where so many burners come from, or, you know, Wanderlust is held in Squaw Valley or Bhakti Fest is held here in Joshua Tree, all in California, the state percentage for non-Hispanic whites is only about 38% white. And New York as well is... you know, where Wanderlust headquarters are, is somewhere around 32 or 33% non-Hispanic white. Even wow. Nevada is only about 47% non-Hispanic white. So, I mean, and most burners are not from Nevada, but that's where the event is held. So what I found was that not only are these kind of white spaces but that they are attracting whites into spaces and not attracting non-whites into those spaces. And so the whole question of the book then began to wonder why, what is happening? Where's the whites only sign? Who has hung it, and why is it hung, and why is it still there in 2020?
Yeah, I think anybody who's attended one of these events, you'd have to be blind not to notice that. For myself, as a scholar of South Asian religions, it's something I've seen and witnessed. There's an uncomfortability with it. And I don't think it's something that has really been critically asked from an academic perspective really yet. I think this is one of the kind of exciting things about this book. I think there's been a lot of scholarship on modern postural yoga and the development and even, you know, genealogy and even, you know, demographics of yoga in the United States, yoga in Britain. But, you know, most of the scholarship on modern yoga has focused on the postural yoga. But there's been a lot less critical work done on bhakti and kirtan in the West, outside of India. And those spaces, like postural yoga, are predominantly white. So why is that, Amanda? this is one of the key questions of the book, right? So kind of, what do you find in your research? Why are these spaces predominantly white? And kind of what are some of the bigger ramifications for yoga, for Hinduism, for bhakti, for South Asians? Let's get into a little bit about, you know, what's going on in these whites only or predominantly white spaces.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the somewhat easy answers that people kind of tend to throw at this is like, well, these festivals are expensive, or you have to travel for them. You know, they kind of look to this demographic, maybe like poverty inequality in the United States, for example. And I think that is true in some part. But I also feel that, you know, there are lots of people who are people of color who are spending money in all kinds of ways. People who are going on vacation and people who are, you know, indulging in all kinds of luxuries, and they're not coming here. So while that may explain a little, I don't think that that's really the root of it. And in order to trace the root of it, what I have done, particularly in the first chapter, which is maybe the most critical chapter of the book, is to look at the history of the ways in which the counterculture, and in particularly the spiritual counterculture in the United States, has looked to whatever was the kind of radical other at the time in order to solve the kind of crises of the soul and the wounds of modernity. And that's a bit of a poetic way to put it. I didn't intend for it to come that way, but that's how it came out. And I think that what is happening is that this kind of attraction to alterity, the attraction to the other, is a way out. And so what I really center in the book is that all of this begins with a critique of Western modernity, an understanding that something is not the way it should be with the status quo. And that leads people to look elsewhere, to imagine otherwise worlds, to think beyond the confines of what they have been raised with in their own culture, and then to move toward that alterity as a solution for the contemporary crisis. And that's why the word utopias comes in, is because it's an understanding of something in opposition to the current, which we might view as topia, right? So the idea of searching for something otherwise, searching for something that is a utopia. And so I trace how white folks in particular have mobilized this critique of Western modernity historically through a counterculture that oftentimes turns toward Native religiosity and indigenous religiosities as ancient solutions to contemporary problems. And I think that that same thing is happening with the turn toward Asian religions and toward yoga, toward Hinduism or Bhakti in particular. And that what I found in these fields was that it wasn't kind of just a kind of Saidian understanding of Orientalism, but I use the word exoticism because Native traditions were so readily blended with Asian traditions. So it's in fact the other or the alterity itself that becomes a solution to the crisis of modernity and the kind of loss of self therein.
Hmm. Yeah, you write in the introduction, you pose the question, which I think is kind of the key research question of the book. If I can quote you, how are we to evaluate the ways in which the religious exoticism inherent in spirituality is simultaneously a genuine engagement with alterity, a radically transformative method, and an often exploitative form of cultural appropriation? To this, I answer that it is a complex both and situation. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about that. How, you know, what is the both and to this pivotal question? But I want to say, I really just appreciate that you're framing it along this kind of gradient, that it's that they're acknowledging the genuine engagement with alterity, right? So how do we take these practitioners, teachers, seriously on their own terms? It's very easy to kind of take the low-hanging fruit of cultural appropriation, and we'll get into that maybe more here in a little bit. But to also simultaneously recognize that there is sincerity, there is genuine bhakti and devotion, you know, among some of these lifers, if you will. And I think your book sensitively treads that. And so I appreciated just seeing that balance. But what is the kind of both and to this question of how do we recognize this critique and then also seeing this as genuine engagement with alterity?
Yeah, in some sense, this book was extraordinarily difficult to write because of that, because it really tries to walk a line, as they would say in devotional worlds, a razor's edge, right? Between recognizing the critique, recognizing the violence, and holding this community accountable for its representational practices that are, in fact, deleterious and detrimental to people of color who are trying to represent their own cultures and operate in ideas of autonomy and cultural autonomy, self-autonomy, et cetera. But then also to recognize that people are serious in these fields. And it's not, I feel like I was frustrated by the critiques that I've read in scholarship that were discrediting these worlds as kind of superficial, consumeristic, capitalist-oriented bullshit, honestly.
You tell the story, you even had some trouble getting the research project off the ground because scholars would sort of scoff at, oh, really? You say you have some line where you're like, oh, I didn't realize we were getting paid to just go camp in a tent at a festival or something and essentially hang out with hippies or something like that, right?
Yeah, I feel like I'm a bit insulated from that here in California, where this is actually a large swath of the population. And so most people are relatively familiar and take it seriously. But I would give talks in the Midwest, for example, or on the East Coast, and people would laugh in the audience when I had not told a joke. So it was really interesting the ways in which what it exposed, I think, in the academy, the ways in which we do have conventions about what is real religion and what is fake religion, or what is superficial religion, or what is worthy of our time or worthy of scholarship and what is not. So that was really eye-opening to me as a scholar. But back to your question, I felt like I attended to, and it was impossible to ignore. It wasn't just kind of me asserting this. I really feel like this is one of the strengths of this project, is that it's data driven. I also felt like a lot of the scholarship out there was people asserting their opinions. Whereas I wanted to kind of collect data and let my informants speak for themselves. And they are quite clear that many of them are on a serious, what you would call in the field, spiritual journeys, that they've been engaged with some form of non-Western practice for sometimes decades, in ways that are expressed with conviction. So, for example, you know, if you're waking up at 4 a.m. to do your yoga practice before, even this is kind of in the postural sense, before 8 a.m. work, and then coming home and doing yet another class, and then attending satsangs and attending kirtans in the evening, and, you know, the ways in which these worlds inform people's bodily habitus, they inform people's disciplinary lives, their ascetic practice, their mystical intentions or aspirations, all of that I felt like was worthy of recognition. And to then get at the root of why this was particularly attractive to a particular demographic, and what the effects of that were, and how this often very well-intentioned population might reconsider the effects of their actions and how to act in more solidarity with the peoples whose practices that they are deeply engaging with and admire.
You talk in the book about the difference between universal versus local knowledge. And you tell a story, a very interesting anecdote about your graduate studies at UChicago, where Gwyneth Paltrow, the actress, appears at UChicago in your Sanskrit class and recites from memory some of the Yoga Sutras in Sanskrit. So talk about universal versus local knowledge, and how Gwyneth Paltrow chanting Sanskrit at UChicago relates.
I think she chanted to Wendy Doniger, my Sanskrit teacher at the time.
That's amazing.
Yeah. But it was just, I think I used that example because at the time, and I took a little holiday last weekend, and in the hotel room, they were replaying old Saturday Night Lives. And there was, what's her name? Gwen Stefani from No Doubt, doing her like Saturday Night Live debut from whatever that was, 97. And she had full henna and a bindi, you know, so that was a particular moment, of course, is my point, in the early, late 90s.
And Madonna and Sting and all.
Yeah, Madonna, right? Sting, Gwyneth Paltrow. But, and so all of these kind of public figures who were all white were being critiqued for their kind of appropriation of South Asian culture and yoga. But I thought it was shocking to me that despite this kind of broad media critique of Gwyneth Paltrow as this kind of like vacuous, white, wealthy woman doing yoga, that she actually recited the Yoga Sutras in Sanskrit. So that was something that, you know, I certainly couldn't do. I believe that happened to me in second year Sanskrit. So it was not at that level just yet.
Mm-hmm. That must have been quite a day. We have a guest in our class.
No. She didn't come straight to the class. She did it for Wendy. I want to be clear about that. I never met Gwyneth Paltrow. But at any rate, the whole difference, I mean, the first chapter gives the kind of broad brushstrokes of a long history of romantic Orientalism, of religious exoticism, this kind of positioning of alterity or the stranger as the solution to, or yeah, alterity as a solution to crisis of Western modernity. But that I think is kind of macroscopic. And so to get a bit closer to the yoga world, because yoga is one of the primary field sites, I guess, of this book, of the ways in which I could ground the analysis into something that was tangible and local and readily identifiable and where I could look through the rhetoric. I looked at just at yoga classes, at what yoga teachers were saying in the yoga classes, and also how students were interpreting that and reiterating that in their own worlds. And I found what we might call kind of a broad brushstrokes divide between universal knowledge and local knowledge. Local knowledge was a kind of group of yogis who were interested in tracing their lineage, who were interested in identifying India and even potentially like India spiritual, Indic spiritual teachers as the roots of yogic knowledge. And they were in their closeness to that or their veneration of that, they would oftentimes spend time in India or go back and forth to India. And while we might think that this is kind of the way out of the cultural appropriation critique, I found that sometimes these teachers would in fact romanticize India and to have promotional materials, for example, that would say things like, come on our trip to India this summer, the seat of spirituality where the people are filled with bhakti and the air itself is devotional, right? This kind of reimagining of a sacred and mystical and spiritual India that it easily alighted with and reinvented Orientalist understandings of India. So that had its dangers as well. And then they had oftentimes the people who were interested in local knowledge would be performing aspects of what they imagined to be Indianness. So for example, these were people who would potentially be more likely to be bhaktas, dressed in Indian clothing, you know, wear the bindi with the henna on the hands, that kind of group, right? Mm-hmm. Then on the other side, there was what I characterized as universal knowledge, which were people who had kind of looked to see that yoga was intended to be spread globally and that it was India's gift to the world, but that now that that gift has been given, really the only barometer of yogic authenticity was their own personal experience. So this is a much more an idea that coincides with theological or philosophical strains in contemporary spirituality in general, where the barometer for the real, even in quite broad terms, is one's own experience. So if I feel it, then it's true for me. And that truth is relative and changing over time, which then somehow with that kind of perspective, it enables people to dissociate the tradition from India and to locate authority in their own interpretation. So I found that while both of these were fascinating, the end result was that in both perspectives, they ended up justifying white predominance in the yogic field. And neither one was acting in partnership or in solidarity, or what I use in the book is the term friendship. What would it be if we imagined these worlds as operating in friendship, in relational partnership with the cultures and the people, not just the things or the ideas, but the people of the cultures in question.
Right. I mean, one thing you highlight in the book and others, you know, who are doing work in this area, you know, often note is that, you know, in these, whether it's a yoga classroom space or here in the festival or a kirtan space, although we can locate the Indic roots and sources of these practices, of these mantras, of images of these Hindu deities, we can locate them in India. These majority or even often all white spaces are so excluding to Indian and Hindu people themselves, and that this is felt very apparently in a space like Bhakti Fest that has so few Desi or, you know, South Asian, you know, Hindus in attendance. And so you ask the question in the book, you know, what would yoga look like today if American yoga practitioners were sharing space with contemporary Indian yogis? When I read that, I was wondering if you meant yogis in India, Indian yogis who are practicing yoga today in contemporary India, or immigrated Indian populations, diasporic Indians in the United States today. Because I think, as you rightly note, and this makes, you know, all of these conversations a little bit more complex, is that there really are differences in the ways in which yoga is practiced and constructed in India today versus outside of India.
And I guess my answer would be, I don't really care either, either in both, right? What would it mean for these yogic spaces to incorporate more South Asian voices, whether they come from India or mm-hmm. they come from the US? I don't want to create what we might view as like a secondary essentialism, wherein people are elevated only because they have melanin in their skin, right? I don't think that that's the intention here. But I do think that right now, what I see in yoga in particular, since we're talking about yoga, is a crisis of representation, where somehow over the course of several generations, no matter whether you identify yoga as a pure and authentic practice from India or you a universal gift to the world, we still have an extraordinary domination by only white teachers. And so something is happening there. And I think what I am encouraging, or, you know, it's not a very constructivist book, I'm recognizing what I see as a problem and putting out some of the reasons for that. But in the moments that I kind of do a little bit of constructivist work, I think about what it would mean to share space. And that could mean diversifying to include South Asian perspectives from India, yogic perspectives from South Asia, or it could mean including more South Asian American yoga teachers. But I don't think that the kind of current status quo is sustainable. And I think that we should look at why it is like that and work to operate in closer solidarity to the cultural roots of the practice.
As I was reading the book, you know, the last couple of days, and I've been thinking about this, you know, a lot over the, who knows how long now, but really since, you know, more of these discourses over the last few years, especially, have become more and more pronounced. You know, the analogy, especially in terms of cultural appropriation and exploitation and religious exoticism and these things that are really coming out so strongly in your work in these communities. The parallel in my mind as kind of a historian of religion, scholar of South Asian religions, the parallel of Buddhism and the transportation of Buddhism globally, and it comes to mind. And I wanted to put this out here as a potential analogy to maybe what's going on here, and to think through this a little bit to see, you know, how might the case of Buddhism be similar or different to what's happening now with yoga, particularly if we focus on yoga in North America. But the history of Buddhism, right, we know originated in India, but went on to be transported transnationally outside of India, throughout Asia, eventually throughout the world. But in particular, it went to China. And in the early centuries of the Common Era, I mean, many different, you know, there's traditional narratives about how this took place, Bodhidharma and many others who transmitted Indian Buddhism to China. But then in the preceding centuries, it took on its own unique cultural and linguistic flavors in China as Buddhism was practiced by ethnically Chinese populations. Chinese Buddhists looked to India in what you could might even call religious exoticism, right? For authenticity and authority. It was the texts that came from India, those scriptures that were authentic, that were the Buddha Vachana, the speech of the Buddha. Those were the texts that were then translated into Chinese. But it was being practiced by Chinese, not by Indians in, you know, necessarily in China, although surely there were Indian Brahmins who were coming to China. I'm no expert at all, you know, on Chinese Buddhism or this history. So this is a very imperfect summary or overview of a complex history of transmission, right? But what's interesting is, you know, over time, and we have the benefit of, you know, almost 2,000 years now of history where that tradition has developed and flourished into Han and Chan Buddhism, Chinese Buddhism, that then became Zen as it went on to Korea and Japan and so forth. Nobody would say that Chinese Buddhism is inauthentic today, or like you wouldn't look at a Buddhist in China and say that they've completely exploited or taken advantage of another's tradition, because over the course of time that has become so inflected in their own culture and civilization, it's become Chinese Buddhism, right? So I wonder, is that sort of thing happening in our midst with yoga today in America, elsewhere, as yoga becomes more transnational? What are some of the ways that it might be similar to the story of Buddhism? What are some of the ways in which, no, it's quite different? As I kind of just put that out at you, are there any thoughts that come to mind about how what's going on today in America with yoga and bhakti and these festivals is similar to that? Are we in the midst of American yoga and American bhakti that has its own distinct characteristics and that might not even be recognized by an Indian Hindu as their own tradition because it's sort of becoming something else?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the classic example that people use. So yes, I've heard that before and I've definitely thought of it before. I think that, first of all, we need a couple thousand years, maybe 1,000 years, to know the answer to that. Second, I think, you know, I'm not an expert in, you know, 8th century dialogue between India and China, but I do know that there were a lot of teachers going back and forth between India and China from the 8th century to the 12th century, that in fact, there was a considerable amount of dialogue between those two spaces, and adoptions of Buddhism that went across East Asia into Korea and Japan in dialogical ways, mm-hmm. right? The third thing that I would just mention in response to that is that we absolutely cannot imagine that this exchange of culture operates in any sense outside of white supremacy, right? I mean, that's the fundamental problem, in that if in the current context, if, for example, a white yoga teacher does nothing, they are operating in that context where, for example, media time is more likely to be given to white voices, where job opportunities are more likely to be given to white voices, on and on and on down the road, right? So there's a sense in which that provides a very different context. And the history of not only white supremacy, but white possessivism, I draw on the work of Eileen Morton Robinson here, who's an Indigenous Australian scholar. And that's why I think we see not only kind of the possessive use of yoga, but this blending between all kinds of different non-Western cultures that are viewed and deemed to be exotic, right? Where you have the chakra alignment happening inside of the teepee, for example. That is a very distinctive form that is very different from a dialogical transmission of an idea or a practice or even a religiosity. So precisely that kind of pre-modern Buddhist dialogue is what I am looking for and potentially not finding enough of in these communities today.
I mean, when it's complicated, isn't it? Because, you know, and you do point this out in the book. It's something I would like to hear more about, and I think future scholarship on, I think both with the histories of bhakti in North America and postural yoga, there is a bit of the dialogical nature in it, although we have to be very sensitive to the imbalances of power in the flow of this knowledge and practices, but it is the case that we have the Indian gurus coming to the West and spreading teachings to North America, South America, Europe, right, in the 60s and 70s. It's not only that, you know, white Euro-Americans are going to India and extracting practices and traditions. It is going...
I mean, that's my field of study, of course.
Right. And so, and that's where you get back to your kind of universal knowledge distinguishing, you know, for the BKS Iyengars, the Patabi Joyce, Desikachars, the students of Shivananda and so forth, they were yoga missionaries of sort, right? They were intentionally spreading those practices and teachings outside of India in English, you know, across religions.
Yeah, of course. And I want to, because I know we're running short on time, I want to be very clear. I feel like your line of questioning is under the assumption that I'm suggesting that potentially people should not do yoga or something like that. And that's certainly not the intention of the book whatsoever. The intention of the book is to have people consider in what ways are they operating in collaboration with the roots of yoga, with South Asian peoples? In what ways are yogic spaces shared spaces that are celebrating Indic cultural forms? And not only that, but operating in shared mutual dialogue with people of color. Mm-hmm.
That's important. So as we start to kind of wrap up here, because I know I want to be respectful of your time, are there any kind of final conclusions or further thoughts, anything that we didn't get to touch on in this conversation today that you feel important to share, or that you've kind of taken away from having done this huge and very personal research project as well? I mean, one thing we didn't really get into as much, but I did want to talk about, you know, the participant observer nature of this project and how personal really this project was for you, that comes across in your writing of the book. But any final kind of takeaways that you're left with at the end of this book project and as it's now kind of out in the world?
Yeah, I think I would say, just to continue what, you know, that last bit that we were talking about, is that this is an extraordinary space where people are, I mean, we didn't talk about kind of chapters 3 and 4, which are about ascetical practices that are happening in these spaces, or mystical experiences that are highly transformative for people who are living in these worlds. And those are very important moments of what one of my participants, Nico, called kind of spiritual evolution of these communities. And so I want to really validate just how much transformation and introspection is happening in these worlds, while acknowledging that that's not the, in my opinion, that kind of the crux of the problem. That's not the issue. It's wonderful that people are having these kind of experiences, and more people should be cultivating self-awareness and introspection in their lives, I think the question for me becomes a question of representation and how that representational politics then is disseminated and how that might be done in different ways in to build other than white utopias.
Yeah. And you cite a couple examples along the way of work or sites where that is taking place, like the Prasada Festival as an example of a more South Asian oriented, like highlighting South Asian kirtan artists and musicians on their lineup. Are there other things like that we can point to of that kind of work that you've encountered that's happening?
I think there's a lot of really interesting activists working in this field, and we are in a very unique time when I'm seeing more airtime coming. I guess I'm not going to run through the citations of the book, but you know, Sapia, the Prasada Festival, there's many, many. And I think that's one of the ways in which sometimes, I don't want to say lazy, but sometimes in these communities, there's like this impulse or this idea that South Asian practitioners are not out there. And they absolutely are. So, you know, since I know there are some yoga teachers and dedicated yogis who listen to this podcast, I would say, please do look. There's lots of wonderful people out there doing extraordinary things. And there's a way to create our communities to be more inclusive.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Amanda. Congrats again, you know, on the book. And thank you for, you know, walking us through it and for putting this out there. I really encourage everybody read it. As an academic and a scholarly work, I think it's very readable, and I think it's very relevant and important to move dialogue and discourse forward and to think about how we want to envision these spaces and communities and how inclusive we want them to be moving forward as yoga and bhakti in these communities are continuing to grow and evolve today. So thank you so much again, Amanda, and I look forward to being in touch with you, and we'll leave it there for now. Thank you to our listeners, and everybody, please take care. Amanda, have a great Thanksgiving and holiday season coming up.
Thanks so much for the invite, and it's been a real pleasure to just have this conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Yogic Studies podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes or sharing this episode with someone else. Thanks so much, everyone. Until next time, please take care.